It's a pleasure to see you all here this morning. I'm grateful that you're willing to take time out of your schedule to participate in Lancaster Seminary's 12th annual LGBT, now QIA, week. I'm trying to keep up with the letters, I promise. For 12 years, we have been gathering and celebrating the contributions of LGBTQIA people, not only in our community, but in the world. We have had guest lecturers from around the country as part of those week's celebrations. We've had great lectures here. I think many of you have participated in those. And so we're grateful to have another wonderful lecture this morning. I would like to take just a moment to thank the LGBT Allies group for all the work that they did this year in preparing for this week, preparing both for the worship service yesterday, which was very beautiful and inspiring, as well as preparing for today's lecture and for the ongoing work that they do throughout the year. We thank you, LGBT Allies, for your good work. One of the exciting pieces about our LGBTQIA celebrations is that we continue to partner with other communities and institutions in this important world-transforming work. And one of our partners is the Human Rights Campaign, as you know. And we're very grateful to Sharon Groves of the Human Rights Campaign, who is the director of the Religion and Faith Program there, who is really responsible for bringing our speaker to us this year. So we're grateful for the sponsorship of the Human Rights Campaign. If you're interested in knowing more about them, you can check them out at hrc.org. When I spoke with Sharon, I guess it was last year now, I said, I want an exciting lecture again this year. Who do you suggest? And with hardly any hesitation, the first name out of her mouth was Nikki Young. And I have to say that getting to know Nikki, I can see exactly why Sharon sent her to us. Nikki is a 2011 graduate from the Graduate Division of Religion at Emory University. Yay, Emory. We're taking over. We're spreading out. Nikki's dissertation topic was a work of social ethics, integrating moral norms of kinship and family that foreground the intersection of race, gender, and sexuality. She introduces Black queer ethics as a new theoretical perspective and method that investigates human ways of being. Before she received her PhD, she received a Master of Theology as well as a Master of Divinity from Candler School of Theology and a Bachelor of Arts from the University of North Carolina at Asheville. Her list of distinctions and awards are many, but I want to point out just a couple of them that I think are very important, her most recent ones, and that is that she was, I think, the very first dissertation scholarship winner from the Human Rights Campaign. It's a new program that they have developed. She was a dissertation fellowship recipient for the Fund for Theological Initiative, as well as received a doctoral fellowship from the Fund for Theological Education. She currently is a visiting professor at Bucknell University, teaching courses in Introduction to Women's and Gender Studies, Global Feminisms and Religion, and Queer Studies. Some of you would be delighted to know that before her time at Bucknell, she was also a mentor in the Summer Academy program of the Youth Theological Initiative at Candler Theological School of Theology. She's a very active scholar. Her list of publications, I can't even keep up. I'm sort of jealous. And again, I'm only going to mention a couple of recent pieces that she's done. In 2011, in Religious Studies, she published an article on being a scholar activist. And in 2010, she published an article, Decentering Religion as Queer Pedagogical Practice. Her forthcoming article is From Freedom to Potentiality, a Black Queer Reading of Savings' Human Condition, which will be featured in the Journal of Feminist Studies in Religion. She's a member of the American Academy of Religion, the Association of Feminist Ethics and Social Theory, the National Women's Studies Association, the Society for Christian Ethics, and the Southeastern Women's Studies Association. This morning we had a great conversation over breakfast, and I could hardly contain my excitement at the conversation with Nikki. So it's with great pleasure that I introduce our speaker this morning, Nikki Young. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much. To President Carol Litch, whose leadership in this community is both generous and generative, Dean David Malott, who was kind enough to invite me to join you for this occasion and to take me to breakfast this morning, the Human Rights Campaign, which David has already mentioned, especially Sharon Groves, whose work in the Religion and Faith program keeps important conversations alive, Reverend Harry Knox, formerly of the Human Rights Campaign, whose unassuming style of leadership is truly a model of spiritual and spirit-filled activism, which he talked about with you last year. The LTS faculty, especially Dr. Valerie Bridgman, whose work inside and outside the academy inspires me. The staff, especially Ms. April Bupp and Ms. Rachel Gahn, who efficiently and kindly arranged my travel and accommodations. The students who hallow these walls each year with your commitment to learning and growing. Especially Michael, who let me in my room last night. And Bryant, who took me out to dinner and invigorated me with a wonderful conversation. And finally, the LTS allies, who continue the vision from 2000 to foster a transformed community. Thank you. Thank you for welcoming me into this active, spiritual, and academic place. I bring you greetings from Bucknell University in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania, just up the road, where my partner and two dogs are actually asking out loud, "Did it just snow before Halloween?" I must say, my move from Atlanta, Georgia to central Pennsylvania has been full of surprises that have certainly broadened my notion of family life. As a matter of fact, I'm going to share a few of those with you, a few requirements about family that we learned once we moved there. First, one must be a lesbian, or at least bi-curious. We have discovered that Lewisburg is a hotbed, no pun intended, for lesbians of all ages. We actually know couples who have been together and lived in Lewisburg longer than I've been alive. Second, one must either have children or pets, and to solidify cliches, preferably dogs. Third, to accommodate this blended species of family and travel, one must drive a Subaru Outback or some similarly shaped all-terrain vehicle. Apparently, this also helps in the snow. Fourth, and most important, one must be able to grow at least 75% of one's own groceries. This indeed means being able to wield the necessary tools and generally tell the produce in the garden apart. Needless to say that our suburban family, two black dreadlocked lesbians and their many dachshund mixes, were in for a shock when we moved to Lewisburg. We were driven into a panic because we fit some of the requirements of family life there, but not all of them. We didn't know how to compost or to weed the lawn, and we drive matchbook-sized cars, but we were still pleased by the hospitality and general queerness of the place. And this is how I feel about being at LTS today. As my time allows this morning, I'd like us to have two parallel conversations, or, well, actually, I want to talk about two things at the same time and have you, with your lightning-fast brilliance, decipher those things. I want you to think simultaneously about my explicit message and the implicit suggestion that holds it up. I'll even help you by telling you what both of the messages are. The explicit message is this: imagination is a process of moral agency that I value as an ethicist because of its capacity to dismantle institutions and also to dismantle structures that limit the creative nature of humanity. I specifically value the process of imagining new relationships, as the title of my talk suggests, because doing so gives us the opportunity to break down what I find to be frighteningly capitalist-oriented relationships. Don't worry, I'll say a little bit more about that later. As for the implicit message, I'd like you to think about this for the next half hour. If we expand and even shake up our perceptions of what is good and holy, we will find a great richness of resources in our peers. Learning about who we are and who we ought to be in relation to one another will not have to be an exercise of historic excavation. Instead, we can perceive and learn from moral exemplars in our presence. So, I always think it's a good idea to share my assumptions when I'm giving a talk. What drives me to the subject of imagination, Black queers, family? What do I generally believe about those things? What am I working towards? What am I working away from? One of the main assumptions driving this conversation is my belief that capitalist-oriented relationships, ones that privilege independence over interdependence, possession over relation, are at best simply not freeing. At worst, they're detrimental to our individual and collective survival. Now, in the direction of hope, I also assume that there are lots of other possibilities for how we can relate to one another, and that we are called to imagine how to do relationships differently. Finally, I assume that imagination, while defined by creativity, creating new things, is also a process of perceiving what already is, but perhaps not recognized. That's why I offer for our reflection the example of Black queers and the way our imagination relative to families might inspire all of our creation and relationships, all of our creativity. I am unashamedly suggesting that Black queer people, like any other group, possess moral excellence from which we can and should glean various resources, including new and creative ways of doing family. Now, before I go on, I should probably address a point of language. It's the big pink boa-wearing elephant in the room, the term queer. Why am I using this word in particular? It has such a troubled history. How can it be used in a context of redemption and creativity? Well, queer is a term that acts as a noun, as an adjective, and as a verb. As an adjective, it describes things, people, circumstances that are abnormal and perhaps even undesirable. As a noun, it designates those things that are abnormal and positioned outside of what the norm is. In relation to queerness, it normalizes the concept, or queerness normalizes the concept of the norm, right? But I like to use queer as a verb. As a verb, it performs. It illustrates the norm itself is not natural. Through the process of illustrating this unnaturalness of a norm, queer disrupts structures of meaning. It interrogates what normativity is. It's asking questions. It illuminates alterity. Right? It dismantles hierarchy and destabilizes fixity. Basically, it passes judgment. I should also take a moment to explain my interest in relationships and relationality. The way I understand it, relationships compel us to recognize our interconnectedness, the implicit yet pervasive notion that each of us is a part of a whole. This idea of being a part of a whole challenges notions of individualism and independence and calls our attention to a fundamental togetherness in humanity. Often, when we think about how people relate, especially within families, our narratives begin with how each of us develops as an autonomous individual. As the story goes, each singular I is defined by autonomy and a kind of fixity of a self that is independent from other selves. These I's possess absolute ability for self-determination. We get the story from several sources, including the Enlightenment, modernity, post-modernity, discourses in economic, religious, and family contexts. But the way I see it, our stories should actually begin with an irreducible we. Queer, again being used as a verb here, interrogates what's normal about an ideology of autonomy, right? And it insists that we predicates the I. In scholarly queer discourse, for example, Judith Butler's work is known for doing this kind of work. She pushes us to recognize how we're made by and with one another. So when I focus on new possibilities for relationships, I'm urging us to turn our attention to a more queer understanding of what it means to relate as people. To relate as people who are not essentially separate from one another, but who are fundamentally and irrevocably linked. Now, one hindrance to this link is what I've named as a capitalist-oriented set of relationships. What do I mean by that? And why do I keep trying to ruin this perfectly palatable conversation about queer stuff with capitalism? Let me say, as an aside, I have definitely found it more difficult to have conversations about capitalism as a problematic structure than to have conversations about queer sexuality. But this morning, I'm not actually trying to argue against capitalism as an economic system. You can invite me back for that talk. I just want to point out that capitalist schemes within families are detrimental to a sort of liberatory, life-giving set of relationships. So I'll just put it out there. Capitalism has colonized the family in at least two ways. First, there's an ideological connection between capitalist values and values that have crept up in family discourse. Here are four that may seem familiar to you and that are quite pervasive and certainly effective in regulating relationship dynamics. Individualism and independence. Private ownership and dominion. Singular and often male leadership. A division between the public and private sectors or spheres. Right? Each of these values is present in both capitalist language and discourse around families. Right? And each of these simultaneously privileges an autonomous I and breeds inequality in doing so. The second way that capitalism has colonized the family is in relation to materiality. Now, when society is expressing and politically acting on fears about the breakdown of family, which we most often see in conversations around same-sex marriage, things like that, these fears are often materially based. They're anchored in a discomfort around the dismantling of a system of connections that ensure the protection of sexual and financial access to intimate partners, that regulate the passing of possessions, and enforce a standard of responsibility and provisions for owning offspring. In this way, capitalist-oriented constructs of family define status, meaning they dole out different amounts of freedom, power, privilege, and resources. Capitalist-oriented families perpetuate inequality among people within the family. This manifests most visibly, and we could talk about the history, in the establishment and enforcement of sex and gender roles, the regulation of heteronormativity, and the general punishment of difference. But what if we can imagine something different? What if our relationships were founded on a different system of economies? How could we envision such a thing? Well, our old friend Paul had faith that such a vision was possible. Now, I couldn't come to a seminary and not take a text. So here goes. In the 12th chapter of his letter to the Romans, in the first half of the verse, Paul admonishes the people, "Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your minds." Turning away from what you know is possible. But you have to see something new, something odd even. Now, Paul may have a thing or two to say about queers in the New Testament, and we certainly don't have time to dissect that today. But what we can do is pay attention to, and I'll say it, the imaginative queerness of his words. If we apply those words to this conversation, to what I'm talking about now, Paul might be saying something like, "We don't have to continue with the business of compulsory and obligatory performance of what is normal, like capitalist-oriented relationships, for example. Rather, we can participate in the creation and perhaps the creative and perhaps even prophetic process of transformation, fundamentally turning ourselves into something that we have a hand in creating." Imagine that. And what's required to perform this transformation is also clear. A renewing of our minds. Not a refreshing. Not a going back and excavating. But a renewing. This is a call to have our minds changed into something that we haven't even perceived yet. This, I suggest, is a call to imagination. Imagination enhances our ability to see alternative futures that start at one point and lead to lots of different directions. And there are two ways I'd like us to think about imagining this morning. First, the process of imagining entails seeing in these multiple directions. It's a kind of multifocal perceptive capacity. In this way, and in relation to families, the process of imagining might be understood as survivalist because it allows us as individuals and as communities, to perceive circumstances that might be different from the realities in which we exist. And this has always been important for oppressed people, right? To see something other than what's going on. Second, imagining makes possible a really wonderful kind of queer world making. It's a way of participating in the creation of a queer future. We might understand this part of imagination as prophetic because it makes room not only for a vision that replaces what's current in reality, but also inspires us to make those new possibilities real. Now, our ability to perceive and attune ourselves to our reality is a prerequisite to creating new worlds for ourselves. It's a capacity to imagine something rooted in the challenge of the real world, right? Hear me saying that we can critique and deconstruct what's happening in the real world. We have to do that as a way to give birth to that which does not exist yet. If we attune ourselves to the realities of our surrounding, we make it easier to subvert realities, those realities, by constructing new ones. We have to perceive what is real before we can turn to what's possible. Now, in my research, I have witnessed Black queer people becoming more conscientized about the dynamics within and the economies of families that constitute a certain kind of capitalist relationship. And they do so by creating space to imagine a different and queer future for those relationships. Instead of remaining situated with a compulsory set of family economies based on norms of gender, race, sexuality, ability, folks have drawn on imagination to cultivate ideas of what they haven't seen before. In doing so, many of us have challenged the notion of what is real. We've blended a normative present with a queer future. But what kind of future is this? What does it mean to have a future filled with queer possibilities? Well, we're suggesting that it's important to transform both individuals and society, right? To generate alterity in opposition to what is stagnant in economies of relationship, to dismantle what is present and then use it to create something different. As our imaginative capacities translate to world-making, we not only create the worlds that we wish to inhabit, but we can transform the worlds that we're already in. Right? So we're both creating something new and transforming what is. Black queer survival in our context, which is arguably hostile to difference, is evidence of how imagining and enacting possibilities allows folks to inhabit a space that is altered and created at the same time. In a few moments, I'll share some examples of my research, participants' experiences, and reflections on this type of Black queer survival. First, I'd like to just mention the concept of queer relationality as a way to begin the process of breaking down capitalist-oriented families. Queer relationality is both a mechanism for subverting capitalist economies and a practice of instituting new behavioral patterns that foster individual and collective flourishing. Janet Jacobson, who you might know her work, she's up at Columbia at Barnard College. She also went to Emory. We are taking over the world. That's true. She's developed this concept of queer relationality, suggesting that nuclear families as a normative standard reify capitalist norms and threaten their survival of non-normative kinship. In response to this threat, people have visioned and implemented other modes of being in relationship. One such example is African-American families and communities who for generations, have organized ourselves around creative ways to survive. We've survived in a social, political, economic, often religious set of contexts that privilege families unlike our own. Our families have been based as heartily on the connections and accountability mechanisms within a fictive kinship structure as it has been any other logical form of relationality. These kinds of networks that African American people have used result from a range of circumstances, but they haven't been limited to things like caring for our vulnerable, right? Sustaining ourselves economically, surviving in a socially hostile environment. Similar to the example of African American families in general, queer relations makes room for the innovation and creative response to life circumstances. What's interesting about Janet Jacobson's notion of queer relationality is the way that relationships, along with the expectations and the behaviors that they bring, take on new meaning. The relationships themselves, the way that you define portions of the kinship structure, they take on new meaning. And this allows folks to be constituted by something other than the structure of the family. You're not just a daughter because being a daughter means exemplifying a certain set of behaviors relative to your gender. You're a daughter because of the relationship that you have with someone else, right? Queer relationality opens the door for us all to imagine and even experience new ways to constitute ourselves and to think about our constitution in relation to others. Now, according to my research, some of the Black queer folks, and let me say, I did research in Atlanta for my dissertation. I interviewed about 50 Black queer folks around the idea of family. And I got so much out of it. It was probably more beneficial for me. Well, I suppose it was meant to be beneficial for me in my dissertation. But it was certainly life-changing for me, so not just scholarly, it was life-changing. But in that research, I found that some Black queer people are definitely acting and thinking differently about the interpersonal dynamics within families and the role of the family context in shaping identities and selves. As an example, I'd like to share a story about Indigo. Indigo is a black lesbian in her late 20s, although now she's probably 30, 31. Okay, so Indigo is a black lesbian in her late 20s. She was raised by her extended family. She had some difficulties with her biological family with drugs and alcohol and some other things. And eventually she was raised by a foster family that took her in. The foster family was a pillar in the Pentecostal Christian community. Indigo was certainly raised in that space and aspired to leadership in that space as well. But when she came out as a lesbian to her foster mother, Indigo was ridiculed, kicked out of their home, and denied further financial support for college. Here is a portion of her reflection on that conversation.
That next summer when I returned to Madison in my internship, it was really hard. I remember when I went, I barely had enough gas to get there. I had no money, nothing. But the internship, I lived in a hotel. I didn't have food. And so I was like, well, I'm going to call my parents. So I remember calling them, and she's like, we ain't going to send you no money, but we'll come up there and take you grocery shopping, because Madison and Racine is about 4 hours away. So when they get there, she refused to come in my room. So I went down there, and I remember she's like, but before we leave, let's sit and talk. So I remember us sitting down in the lobby. I'm like, and then she goes on with her rant. You know, you owe God, and You know, just all the scriptures about hell and she just went there. And I'm just sitting there in tears. And, you know, my godfather's there. And he's just kind of sitting, you know, he looking like, I feel sorry for you. But, you know, he's kind of in between. And then something just in me, I said, you know what? I said, if I haven't learned nothing else about my life, I said, I know what it's like to not eat. I know what it's like to eat. I know what it's like to not have. I can survive all of that. I said, you know what? I am not that hungry. I said, if Christianity hasn't taught me anything, I know how to fast. I said, so I will be okay. I said, I will not do this. I'm not going to pimp myself out, you know, to your verbal abuse for a meal. Thank you, but no thank you. Thank you for driving up here, but I'm not going to do this anymore. So that really changed my perception of family.
Indigo later described this as a moment where her own values of self-assertion, unconditional care, mutually beneficial relationships overrode the capitalist structure of dominance that was trying to play out between her and her foster parents. Reflections from another one of my research participants, Sage, who knows Indigo, offers a fairly good assessment of Indigo's story. I don't have a recording, but I can read you part of it. Sage is a 30-something black lesbian who was raised in a family of black ministers. Having moved now to New Age metaphysical thought, Sage responds, if you were to really strip it all bare, it's capitalism's role in our lives, in the tiniest ways and the hugest ways. That's what makes relationships not be family. Sage says she wants a different and more radical formation of family. She goes on, I guess if the norm is individualism, when you partner with someone or some other person and create a nuclear family, with or without children, where your property is yours, your time is yours, your resources are yours, basically, that's capitalism. I want to move to a place where we operate outside of that, outside of that system, such that we're creating family all over the place. And not necessarily because we're partnering romantically with somebody, or not because we share blood with somebody, but because we're making a choice to have collective work and responsibility, cooperative economics, and growing accountability to one another. For Sage, family values and practices ought to counter the effects of capitalism on relationships. According to her, it's poetic creativity that helps us to practice values like whole health, time together, passion, laughter, intimacy, peace, hope, vulnerability, things that are present in interdependent relationships. Now, based on my conversations with Sage, Indigo, and several other folks, I find that there are at least two foundational features of Black queer values. First, there's creative spontaneity, which Sage mentions. Family connections based on choice can be freeing because they're open to destabilizing dynamics, right? They're open to spontaneous change. Second, there's resilience, which may be understood as the ability to adapt to consequences of failure, right? Or it might be understood as creative healing. Sage was helpful some more. She says, Black queer families are poetic in that there's a light, a spirit, a feeling that's normative beyond ideas and theories and thoughts. It's normal for Black queer families to operate in a jazz mode of creativity and resilience, figuring out ways of meeting the basic needs of life, even the emotional, spiritual ones, when the rest of the world is operating in opposition to you. Just that we exist and are thriving is an extraordinary example of the brilliance that it takes to survive, and the brilliance that's generated from our insistence at survival. From jump, there's no model, there's no norm, because the very fabric life is woven with is flawed. You start from scratch so you can be as free and creative as you have access to being. You start out with a critical lens because what you know in your soul, in your mind, in your body to be true is not what people always tell you is true. Being Black and queer, as I've experienced it, is a gift of vision. I have access to possibilities, choices, and the knowledge of choices. I can search the depths of consciousness. She's going into her Baptist thing at this point. I can search the depths of consciousness and the expansiveness of all creation to make some really good stuff. If it's not clear by now, let me state again as I conclude that I take seriously the ways that Black queer people, and all people really, can transform relationships through the dynamic process of imagination. Even more, I'm excited by the ways that renewed minds, multifocal perceptions, lead to practices that are not conformed to normativity, but that generate possibility. Relating queerly with attention to an economy of relations based on interconnectedness and built on interdependence is a matter of being willing to be made and unmade by the relationships themselves. It's a matter of letting go of the fear of not having and being willing to say, I am not that hungry. In concert with Black queers who graciously share their imaginations and creative ideas with me, I encourage you not to be conformed, to queerly transform yourselves, to renew your minds in the direction of a queer future. My question, because I always leave with a question, is what kinds of relations do you imagine? What kinds of worlds do you want to create? Thank you.
Thank you. We have about 10 or 15 minutes for a conversation, question and answer, discussion. with Nikki. If you raise your hand, I'll bring the microphone back to you. There's got to be some questions. Well, let me start. I'll start with a question. I'm wondering, in your research, if you noticed any difference or any what you noticed in relationship in terms of same-sex couples, two women or two men in this kind of conversation. Were there any differentiations that you noticed?
So there were some folks that I interviewed in couples and then some folks who wanted to be interviewed separately. And I didn't have any gay men who wanted to be interviewed in a couple. So that there might be people that I interviewed that were in a relationship, but they didn't want to be interviewed together. Just based on how the conversations would go, the length of time. But I did find that when some of the lesbians or folks who identified as lesbians were interviewed together, they did a lot more talking back and forth and learning from one another than with me, which was wonderful to witness. When I was interviewing people singly, they were certainly, we were vibing and we were having an intimate exchange. But it was a really positive thing to see how people learned from one another as they shared their stories, and stories that they might not have shared with one another outside of this conversation.
Thank you.
Hello.
Hello.
Thank you so much for blessing us.
Thank you.
My question is about conversations in the current Black church around issues of sexuality. And I'm curious as to if you can give us any tools as to how to bring about those conversations. And even if you foresee any type of change, specifically in the AME or Church of God in Christ or Southern Baptist, do you foresee any transformation amongst those denominations?
Sure. Thanks for that question. So let me start with the second part around the possible transformations in those communities. I'm an optimist, and I believe that religious spaces are transformative spaces, and the ways in which communities choose to transform depends on what's happening in that space at the time. That's a nice way of saying I'm certainly holding out hope for lots of change and development and conversations in those spaces. To the first part of your question, I will say, part of conversations around sexuality that happen in church have to do with how families respond to people asserting their identity in a space, right? The way that we talk about that is coming out. So how are people responding to or dealing with coming out of their family members when they're in a religious community that might not accept that or might accept it on the quiet or whatever? So I participate in one of my activist roles in conducting workshops with a few Black churches in Atlanta about what the coming out process is for everyone in the family, right? It's not just the person who has this non-normative sexuality who's coming out, but it's also the parents, the sisters, the brothers, the children who are also coming out into a new place. Now, as an aside, let me say I do have some political ideas about what it is for queer people to have to come out and about what that means, that sort of we possess a position that has to be iterated when no one else's does. So let's set that aside. But in the coming out process, we have to recognize that multiple people are doing this. So we've conducted workshops through the All My Children Project, an organization in Atlanta, that helps people and families to think about what it is to clue one another into one another. Right? For me to clue you into my identity and you to clue me into what you're experiencing about my identity. Again, this is about having a dynamic of relationships that's not based on me offering a juridical response about myself to you, but for me assuming that we're connected and what you want to know is about my truest self, and what I want to participate with you in is a response to that true self based on your best self. And recognizing that you have to go out into our church community where I might not have any qualms, but you might feel uncomfortable in hearing about what that's like for you as my mom or my aunt. What does it mean for you to go back into our church and have to say, oh, that's so-and-so's friend? Well, That's a specific experience that could be talked about too, outside of the rightness and wrongness of homosexuality, right? We don't even have to have that conversation. But what is it like for you to feel alienated from a community that you're a part of, right? So the conversations that we try to support are ones that privilege the family relationship, right, which privileges the individual identities, as opposed to privileging sort of a notion of the rightness and wrongness of sexuality in the church. That's the direction that we've gone. Thanks for that question.
I need to stand over here and make sure I get on the camera. As you know, the African-American church, culturally speaking, for African-Americans, a lot of times it's like a second family. And sometimes it's your only family. For queer African-Americans in the black church, which they are in, they're in music positions, they're in a choir, sometimes they're the pastor, but they're not out. Do you perceive the African-American church ever come into a place of acceptance of that, of even admitting what's in their church and they know it? And when do you see that happening, and how can that happen? Would that come through the activism of queers, of black queers, or would that come through a change in pastors, or would that come from the congregation telling the pastor, hey, enough is enough, no more sermons like that?
Well, I think you've solved the problem. I think it's coming from all of those directions. Now, one of the difficulties I have often with the ways that we talk about the black church is that it is particularly hostile, or it is particularly homophobic. And that, just let me say, is a tool of racism. I don't support necessarily thinking of the black church as more hostile than any other place. In fact, the black church has shown examples of being quite accepting, right, and quite sort of open. Not necessarily to everyone's loud iteration of their identities, but you can come here and you can eat. You can come here and we'll shelter you. You know, you might have been gone for 40 years, but you're here. I mean, that is a part of the tradition of African American church communities that I've certainly been a part of. So I want to name that it's not necessarily, in my mind, that black churches are more hostile than any other place. That said, I think you pointed out, Will, is that your name? I think you pointed out, Will, the types of things that are necessary in making the space more affirming to the diverse expressions of humanity, right? Leadership. Leadership is a huge deal. You can't stand in the pulpit and say negative things about your members and feel like you're fostering a life-giving community. Like, that doesn't make sense. Pedagogically, like, that doesn't make sense. Also, the community has to rise up. I mean, part of what prophets did was speak to a community, right? They spoke to leadership, but they also spoke to a community. You inspire folks. The assumption behind inspiring a community is that the community will act, right? The relationship there means that the community itself will say, hey, this is what we're experiencing. This is the way that we think things ought to go, right? And then also, not to put all of the onus on queer people to explain themselves to the community, right? Like, it is not my job to teach you to love me. You know what I'm saying? That's not how it should go. What is true, however, is that it might be my job, when I feel safe, to share my truest self with you. That's me saying, I'm not about pushing everyone out of the closet, because the closet sometimes is the place that people can survive in. Okay? I really recognize that. I believe in offering people to come out of the closet when they have a community to support them. But my coming out of the closet can't be the cost of you learning how to be a better person, right? Like, you can't learn how to be a disciple, right, on the blood of my shoulders, right? I can't bear the burden of all of our learning. We have to do this together. So I think the black church, though, has created that sort of space historically. If we learn together, right? This is just another one of those conversations that we have to practice the things that we've learned in that direction. So. Thanks.
Nikki, thank you for, first of all, for the shout out. That was impressive. But also, just for your lecture, I am curious about your research and your further research slash activism. Atlanta, where you are based, has a huge trans community. And I don't know, you didn't mention whether or not you interviewed any trans people. I'm always struck by the two pieces that get left out of that conversation. Bi or plural and trans. So I'm curious about further research as it relates to the configuring of relationality.
Sure. No, thank you. Thank you for that question. So in my interviews, I opened it to everyone, and it's about who responds. There were people who identified as genderqueer, but not transgender, who responded to the call for interviews. But I do know lots of transgender folk. I think moving forward, part of what's underneath my research is the concept of intersectionality, which then destabilizes what queerness is. So you're right to say that the way that some of my research sits levels out the idea of LGBT to sort of sexuality. And where I want to push things is around conversations of gender. And, you know, having more transgender folks specifically targeted for my research will be a part of that. And the way that I want to talk about that is through the lens of intersectionality. Right, what it means. And I'm not talking about intersectionality like your issues come together with my issues, come together with race issues, come together. I don't mean intersectionality in that way. I mean intersectionality in the notion that we're sort of mutually constituted, right, by multiple things. And so if we're thinking about communities in that way, then the diversity of transgender folks within the large umbrella of queerness can push us to think beyond constructs of family that are based on gender. Now, the difficult thing with that is that transgender folks in queer spaces often have different ideas of gender than, let's say, genderqueer folks do, right? So there's a difficult conversation around sort of the essential nature of gender, what it means to live into a normative construct of gender. That's, you know, I mean, it's a difficult conversation to have there. So I'm certainly interested in pushing that conversation and pushing it in the direction of intersectionality. It's creating that noise.
Again, thank you, Dr. Young, for your presentation. As you were sort of talking and offering a critique of sort of capitalist relationality as opposed to queer relationality, it sort of echoed to me of a Martin Buber, I it, I thou. So I'm wondering if that sort of informed any of your work. And
absolutely. Absolutely. I am interested in people being subjects rather than objects. This is informing my work around gender, sort of in women's and gender studies, and absolutely informing what I believe about relationships. An I-it relation is always going to assume that someone else can be dehumanized. And dehumanization is often the first step to violence, right? I mean, we could talk about what that leads to. And so the relationships that I am privileging are trying to eliminate the possibilities for that kind of connection, right? They're trying to privilege an assumption that we are all subjects, right? That we are all dynamic, that we are all interacting, that there's not a situation in which I could own you or you could own me, right? That you can erase a part of my identity to make yourself feel comfortable or safe. Because, FYI, I don't care about your comfort or safety. But yes, that is along the lines. Thank you for that, Nick.
I think we have time for one more question. Someone else? Well, I guess, thank you very much, Nikki.
Thank you.
It's been absolutely fantastic having you with us. For those of you who are guests of us today at Lancaster Theological Seminary, we're grateful that you took the time to be with us. And there's a table outside that has much more information about activities and events that are going on in our seminary. We hope that you'll take a look at that and come back and be with us. I want to thank again the LTS, the allies, the LGBT allies, for their work, good work this week. And thank you, Nikki, for coming with us and coming to us and giving us lots of stimulating ideas to think about, as well as a vision and an inspiration to imagine new possibilities.
Thank you.
Thank you for being with us.
Thanks so much. It's been wonderful to be here. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you so much.